around in this great big city. Fast money and the life will never show you no pity. Oh, I work hard trying to make my bones. But times have changed and I just got to move. Can't run away, can't run away, can't run. I can't run away, can't run away from the things that I've done.
Good evening and welcome to the Frank Collada Show, Frank's World, where Frank's guests will include former mobsters and lawmen, businessmen and women, and entertainers. We will not be taking phone calls this evening, but you can participate in tonight's show through our live interactive chat room. Tonight, Frank's guest is John DeMore, author, screenwriter, and musician. My name's Denny Griffin, and without further ado, here's the man himself, Mr. Frank Collada. Welcome, Frank.
Thanks, Denny. Hello, audience. I'm glad you were able to participate in this broadcast that I'm putting out here today. And my guest is a very interesting man. His name is John DeMore, and he's written a book, and I've read a little bit of it, and it's a very good book from what I've read. He is also going to be a guest at MobCon in September the 26th, 27th, and 28th, and he's going to be one of the speakers there. And without going any further, I would like you to meet John. John?
Good evening, Frank. How you doing?
I'm doing all right, John. I want to ask you a question.
Please.
This book, The Boss Always Sits in the Back?
Yeah.
All right? What inspired that name, The Boss Always Sits in the Back?
Well, that's a great question. You know, realistically, pretty much everybody who would listen to this show knows that if you're a boss, just your position of hierarchy, you sit in the back. But it really comes down to a matter of protection. As it was put to me when I was working on some tape recordings that a local Jersey guy tapped, and I had to listen to his tapes to see if there was any editing that had gone on within it. He actually said that when he was offered a seat in the front of a Cadillac, he asked an undercover cop, "Are you the boss?" And the cop said, "Nope." And then this guy I knew said, "Well, good, you sit in the front, because the boss always sits in the back." And when I heard that, I always said to myself, should I ever write a book about these people, that's going to be the name of the book.
Well, it's a good name, and it's got a lot of reality there because, of course, I had a boss, which was Tony Spaccio and Joe Lombardo and a few guys.
Uh-huh.
And whenever we rode in the car, they always sat in the back, all right?
That's right.
And then on sit-downs, they always sat in the back of the room and listened to the sit-down. Anyway, what I'm trying to tell you, so you told me about that. Prior to your book being released, did you know quickly you'd get your fans' base with 1,000, that you would sell 1,000 copies sold? Did you realize that you would sell?
Did I know? Well, I got to tell you, and this is absolutely a true story, I really didn't know how well it would take off until I actually went on Facebook. And believe me when I tell you, I'm not a big fan of it, but because of knowing that the book was going to be coming out, I went on Facebook. And at the time, I was living in Los Angeles, and there was a page called I Grew Up in Union City, and I grew up in Union City, New Jersey. And I went there, and of course, you know, you find everybody practically that you ever grew up with from first grade on. And I let a couple of people read the manuscript for the book, and they immediately started talking about it to one another. And I saw that this was really going to be something that would be, if I could do this literally in my own old backyard, what I could do nationally would just be fantastic.
So the people you had up there was like the mayor and the chief of police? that's quite a couple of guys you had over there.
Yeah, actually, to be honest with you, I have had some of the most amazing encounters with mayors and chiefs of police and commissioners of police since I wrote the book. Now, of course, you have to remember the things that went on in the book took place from around 1975 to 77. So the people who are in these positions today, they were just kids or they were young teenagers or in their 20s when these things were going on. So now that they're in these positions and they all grew up or worked in an area where the people who are in the book actually lived. And they just loved the story. And after I wrote the book and made arrangements to do a tour of literally half from the middle of New Jersey to northern, all the way to the top of New Jersey, I did this tour, and mayors and police chiefs would show up, the most amazing array of people, just to shake my hand when, oddly enough, and I used to say this all the time, the guys who were up here shaking my hand, the people who were in those positions in the mid-1970s would have wanted to put these guys away. And now it's wonderful. I get to meet them. We talk about it. And they're very interested in the story itself. I'm actually rather proud of the way all that worked out. It has actually earned me a couple of not the fact of what the story is based on, but the fact that a local boy did good by writing a book, self-publishing a book, and making it or getting it to sell as well as it did.
Well, you know, I could understand where you're coming from, because after I wrote a book, I did receive a lot of help from my books through retired FBI agents, Metro Police, federal judges. Once I was on the other side with them, they became friends. So I can understand basically where you're coming from. Now, how does having a name in your honor in the city where you were born raise your feelings?
I'm not embarrassed, but it's the first time I'm really speaking about this. When I first came back to New Jersey, the city I was born in and lived the first 12 years of my life, which, like I said, was Union City, when I did the reading at the cultural center there, I had no knowledge that the three guys who stood up, all wearing suits and walking up to the podium where I was, for a couple of minutes there, I thought I actually was going to get pinched for some reason, but
a comfortable feeling.
It was very interesting, especially since the first guy walked up to the stage and says, "How you doing, John Diamore?" And he told me his name and he says, "I'm the chief of police," and then he stood behind me. And the next guy walks up on stage and shakes my hand and says, "How you doing? I'm the commissioner." And he stands up behind me. So I'm positive they're just going to put both hands behind me and cuff me. But the next guy who walked up was the mayor. And this is of a major city in New Jersey. And he opened up this folder and he read a proclamation where it said that, you know, because I was born and raised there and I've always been one to promote the city as a great place to be, and that I wrote this book that did so well, and they were recognizing me for my talent. They named May 24th, John Diamore Day, and that happened in 2012. Well, to update that, last month, on the 23rd, I actually went back to the second town where from the time I was 12 until I was about 22, we moved only a few miles away to a town. You probably heard it. Joe Pesci even uses it in Goodfellas, a town called Secaucus, New Jersey. And I spent the very good formative years there, going to high school. I became a musician and, you know, started out with all the local guys in Secaucus in various bands, which eventually led me to become the studio musician I then became. But I went back there last May 23rd to promote a concert with the town. The mayor had asked me to put a concert on for the town like I used to do back in the 70s. And again, while I was up on stage getting ready to introduce the band, the mayor walks on stage with a proclamation for May 23rd. So I'm really quite honored by both of those situations. And, you know, there are some people that I certainly did wish or do wish were here to see it. My father, who's been gone for 20 years, and my godfather, Jerry, who is the person I write about most in my book, The Boss Always Sits in the Back, and he's been gone 15 years now. So it's, you know, I just wish that those two guys were around to see this story and what I've done.
Well, that's
a great question. Thanks for asking that.
Let me get a couple more questions out here you can answer.
Sure.
Was that a surprise to you? And how does having a name in your honor in the city where you were born and raised feel? And there's two questions for you. I'm sure it was a surprise to you.
I was completely shocked. I was up on stage, and I had no idea that they were going to do this. And again, these are people of just, you know, in that community of where I live. This is the highest you can get.
And that's an honor, as you said. It's an honor to be born and raised, you know, to feel that. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. It really is. It really is. You know, and the funny thing is, right after the first one happened up in Union City, because my mother and father were from Union City, too. I mean, we go back there a long way. But as soon as I got the honor and the event was over, and I got in my car and I called my mom. I called my mom. I says, okay, Mom, because she lives in out in California now. I said to my mother, I says, okay, Mom, other than Christopher Columbus, what other Italian do you know who has a day named after him? And of course,
that's very good. Yeah, very good.
She had no clue. And so I says, yeah, they did this for me in Union City. And, of course, you know, since that's where our entire family comes from, she started crying on the phone. It was just a wonderful, wonderful feeling.
Now, listen, this is sort of a stupid question. Is this a true story?
For the sake of nobody wanting to do any time, no, it's a novel. It's just a story about some guys I heard and some things that I saw take place.
All right, now let me ask you something else. Considering most of the characters have passed away or are in jail, did you ever worry about any repercussions because you put so many names and details out there?
Not really, Frank, and I'll tell you why. Other than the ones that we all really know, Lucky Luciano, Frank Costello, you know, all the guys, all the New York guys, that their names have gone down in history. And other than anybody named D'Amore, which would be in my family, everybody else's names have been changed. And the funniest part about this is that the guys who aren't away, or the ones who are still alive but aren't away, and I'm still in good contact with, when I started writing this book, I actually went to them and said, I'm writing a book, and it's going to be about some things that went on in Vegas. And you're in it. And what name would you like me to use? So they all picked their own aliases. So I really have no problems, especially at the end, after I finished what was the first draft of the book. You know, as I'm sure you would do the same thing if you were in my position. You know, you made sure that the certain people, it wound up in the hands of certain people to make sure that they were okay with what I was writing about.
Well, you know, I could attest to that because, you know, I don't want to pump my book because everybody knows about my books already. But in my books, I made sure that everything I said was true.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
of course, you're going to find people that are going to come up with their nonsense and say that he's making up stories. Well, you know, let them say what they want to say. It don't make no difference to me. I know it was true, as
you
well know it was true.
There you go. You're right.
These characters, I imagine the characters you're talking about, 98% of them are dead anyway, that you put in your book, because they're a bunch of old guys like me.
Well, that's exactly true. I mean, when I first spoke to my cousin about this, he was very specific when he said, you know, don't you even think about writing this story until three people are dead, and he had to be one of them. And he was the last one to die in 1999, and obviously it took a while to write the book, and it came out in 2012. So he asked, and I honored that. There's pretty much nothing that he asked that I didn't honor. You know, it's how we grew up.
All right, let me ask you this, John. What was it like in the mid-1990s, and you were a 23-year-old young man in Vegas? What was it like for you?
Well, it was I was 22 in 1975. That's when this was happening. And again, Frank, I'm sure I don't have to tell you, it was right around this period the original MGM, was just built. And it was the beginning of the corporations taking over Vegas, and the old Vegas now would slowly disappear.
I was living there when that puppy burned down. I lived a few blocks away from there.
That's right.
So,
well, I even discuss the fire for the MGM in the book, yeah. and how it affected me since I spent so much time there. But what I'm saying is, you know, think about, I mean, 1975, you're 22 years old, and you're in Vegas on your godfather's dime, and you're just told to have a good time. And it was just fantastic. I mean, the only thing that could have been better was that it would have been 1959 Vegas, and, you know, which I really would never be able to imagine what it was like, but... I'm sure you saw the change from the 60s into the 70s and then into the 80s. And so it was a wonderful time and a fantastic experience for a 22-year-old kid.
Yeah, I was older at the time. I don't know, I'm just taking off the top of my head. I was probably in my 40s.
Right.
And it was rock and rolling.
That's right. And I was a musician, too. I mean, I was...
Yeah.
You know, I was working as a session musician, so I really had the best of a couple of different lives. I will not, I will never deny that, you know. And
you're talking only maybe 300,000 people were in the town then. You know,
that's right, and I write about that also, about how when I went back to Vegas in like 1998 after not having been there for 21 years, and even, I mean, you saw it as soon as you were flying over the city to come in for a landing. You know, I remember looking at Vegas from the sky in 1975 to 77, and it was this strip, and about half a mile to a mile on either side of the strip. After that, there was nothing. There was nothing. And now you fly into Vegas, and you see the lights of it beyond the horizon.
Oh.
And I even joke about when I used to get off the plane back in the 70s, you had to walk down the stairs into the heat, into the casino, into the airport terminal. They didn't even have the canopies to come out to meet the plane back then.
Or the escalators to walk the people on.
That's right.
It was old, man. It's all they cared about was getting your money. You know, but
yep.
Hey, that's what people come to Vegas for. It wasn't a kiddie land then.
That's exactly. You know, Vegas, again, to me at that time, was like a Disneyland for adults. You know, and I said I had a ticket I had an e-ticket for all the rides, and it was just fantastic. So it was a great place to be. You know, again, I don't have to tell you, but I have pictures of me standing on the balcony of the MGM Grand, and somebody taking a picture of me from inside the hotel room, so you could see a bit of the strip on the outside. And between, you know, from where I was, you had the Caesar's Palace way off into the right, into the distance. And I think it was like, I can't remember. I think it was the Desert Inn or something off to my left. And there was about a half a mile of sand in between these casinos. And
you know, you'd be lucky.
Wait a minute. It was the Jockey Club. It wasn't the Desert Inn. It was the Jockey Club. It was just right. This huge tract of sand in between these hotels. And now, you know, you can't find sand in Las Vegas.
You can't find a balcony in a casino you could stand on.
That's right. They don't even let you do that anymore.
There's probably four or five casinos with balconies, and I think they even got them locked up. I think they're afraid of people bailing off of them.
How many people were accidentally falling off, yeah.
Yeah.
This
book, John, is very personal, is it not?
Yes, it is. It is. It talks about a, you know,
why?
People ask me, you know, is it, it's just another mob book? No, it's not. It's a love story between a young man and his godfather, and a culture that we were raised up within that meant more than just the blood between us. It really had a lot to do with, you know, this other culture we were raised within, and we needed to honor that as much, if not more, than the family that we belonged to just because we had the same last name.
Well, you know, I'm going to interrupt you a minute, and I just want to shoot something at you. You know, I run a thing out here that's...
I mean, when a guy like you says, I want to shoot something at you, okay? You might want to use the word.
I don't want to shoot you. They might want to arrest me now. Anyway, I'm running a thing called like the Mob Tours. You know, I take people on and I show them the history of Las Vegas.
They
love it, you know what I mean? Because I am actually probably one of the only survivors from the Chicago outfit. I know you from the New York guys or related, you know. But I'm a Chicago guy, so what's left, I'm the only one that can bring that information to them. What factors influenced the making of this novel and the most?
What factors influenced it? I think the most important one was I always knew I had this story in me. And at the beginning, it was just going to be about the Vegas scam. But then when after the scam was over and everybody wound up back in New Jersey, it just escalated from there. Even though my godfather at this point had moved to Palm Springs, and I was done because I was only hanging out with these guys during the mid-70s. I was pretty much done, but then... Like I mentioned earlier, the boss of New Jersey, or at least for the Genovese family, he wound up getting into some trouble and was tape recorded. And because they knew of my knowledge of recording studios back then and when we used to record with tape, they asked me to legitimately check to see if some of the conversations were tampered with, and so I had somebody do some work with the very early audio computers to see if it was, and it was. So the story grew. Now it wasn't just Vegas. It became this story about this guy being framed by the authorities, and so that became another part of the story. And then. And then he was later, you know, he later was killed, and that became a part of the story. And things happened after that. So one thing that started with this Vegas thing back in the 70s kept snowballing into another thing until my life changed dramatically, and I wound up working as a corporate executive for many years. But still, in the back of my head, I always wanted to write this story. And then when I found out, when the family found out, well, first of all, two of the three people that my godfather had told me to wait for were now dead. And once we found out that my godfather, unfortunately, had cancer that he was not going to beat, I knew I needed to tell his story, and I needed to tell the story of these guys. You know, I even say this during my readings. It's like I wanted to tell this story because these guys needed to be written about, and they needed to be immortalized. But the only problem was these guys didn't like to be written about, but they all loved the idea of being immortalized.
It's like when they did the movie The Godfather, you know. We weren't even allowed to go see the movie when it first come out or read the book.
Right.
I remember that. It was like you go to see that movie, you're gonna have a lot of problems.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because they figured it was bullshit, which it was, you know. But it was a good movie, you know. But it was all nonsense. You know what I mean? So you know, I for all my listeners right now, I wish we had the call-ins because you could ask John a lot more questions than I can ask him. And I can tell you this much, buy his book, because I'll tell you what, this book is a good book. I only read a portion of it, and I enjoyed it. So I wouldn't hesitate on getting this book and coming to MobCon and meeting this gentleman personally, because I'm sure he has a whole lot more to say about his being in the entertainment business, whatever.
If anybody is interested in getting a copy of the book, trust me when I tell you that the first editions are practically sold out. As a matter of fact, the last one will probably be sold at MobCon. But if you want a signed first edition, you can either go to Amazon and pay about $150 for a used copy, or you can get a brand new copy by simply writing to John, J-O-N, there's no H, J-O-N, at theBossAlwaysSitsInTheBack.com. Just write and let me know that you heard me on Frank's show, and I'll make sure you get a copy of your book without having to pay shipping.
You're my best guy. Go ahead. Don't be a cheapskate.
Nah, come on. They're your people. If you want a copy, a signed copy of the book, I'll eat the shipping. Don't worry about it.
All right. That's what we want to hear.
Gentlemen, excuse me a second. I've got the, this is Denny. I've got a question in the chat room for John.
Uh-oh.
John, chatter Johnny Law says, hi, with the rounds in the book getting stronger toward his Vegas trips, how does John feel about being in the music industry and making even more trips to Vegas?
Well, I was in the music business literally from the time I graduated high school, hit 18, and I signed my first contract 2 days after that. And I got out of the music business on March 5th, 1985. So I can't honestly say that I'm in it anymore, but I got to tell you, I spent the greatest years of my life playing rock music. I loved it, and though I never played in Vegas, it was great being a musician and going to Vegas because I was getting comped to all the to the shows. You know, I didn't really go to those other shows that the guys were going to. I was going to the shows where great musicians were playing. Guys like Tom Scott was playing saxophone for Neil Sedaka and stuff like that. The guys who were in the Wrecking Crew, who were playing backup music now for Vegas shows. You know, those are the things that I went to see because I liked music so much. It's a great question, Mr. Law. Law, guy named Law calling into a show like this. You don't think that's a setup?
John?
Yeah.
John?
Yeah.
Yeah, we have a caller on the switchboard, and I would like to ask you a question. Ma'am, go ahead and ask John your question, please.
Hi, John. This is Julia.
Hello.
Hello. I am calling wondering if you will be doing any more readings in the near future in New Jersey.
Actually, I just did my last one on June 27th. I was in Metuchen, New Jersey. But oddly enough, I was just contacted today about somebody putting on a small book fair in Jersey City on July 12th. So there's the possibility that I may wind up doing that as the ultimate, very, very, very last reading of The Boss in Northern New Jersey. And then after that, the only thing I'm going to be doing is MobCon in Vegas on at the end of September.
And
well,
that might be New Jersey too.
Thank you.
Well,
okay.
Thank you, John.
You're very
thank
welcome,
you.
Julia.
Hope to talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for the call, Julia. And I hate to say it, but we're out of time.
Yeah,
and I
want
to thank. Yeah, thanks so much, John, for being with us tonight and being Frank's guest.
Thank you for having me, Danny and Frank. Yeah, I look forward to meeting you both out in Vegas. And anytime
and
you want to do
it.
Another show, I'd be happy to be on.
Okay, we'll take you up on that. And
cool.
Thank you to our listeners. And tune in again on July 14th when we'll be back for the next edition of Frank's World. Good night, gentlemen. Good night, Frank. Good night, John. And good night to our listeners.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks, Danny.
Hi, buddy.
Bye.